Welcome to the Share Life podcast with Jason Scott Montoya, where we explore stories and systems to live better and work smarter.
Hey, I'm Jason from the Share Life podcast, and we're doing an inspirational people interview today. Today, I'm here with David Ebner. David, say hello.
Hey, everybody.
David and I are part of a kind of a private marketing mastermind of sorts. Originally got connected through a few mutual friends in this group, which I met through the Atlanta HubSpot hug, is what they call it, the HubSpot user group. So we're both very familiar with HubSpot and have used that over the years. David is the founder of Content Workshop, a storytelling agency that helps brands and businesses understand and tell their stories. He's also the advisor of Copywriter Exchange, which is a group or a community of freelance writers that you can join, copywriterexchange.com. I'm a member of it. I participate in the Slack channel. I've done a webinar based on Path of the Freelancer. So it's definitely a great community if you are a freelancer in the writing space. So definitely check out that. So Content Workshop is his agency, and then Copywriter Exchange is the community which he's an advisor. So anyways, that's a little bit about David. He's also an author and creative person, entrepreneur. And David, tell us from your own point of view, who are you and what's your story?
Yeah, my story, right? We spend so much time telling other stories. every once in a while, we're asked to tell our own. If we're going back to the beginning, right?
Tell us the origin story of your superhero beginnings.
Yeah, right. I'm from originally a small town called Barberton, which is in Northeast Ohio.
Okay. Now, how small is small?
Growing up, I couldn't even tell you anymore. They're barely like a city. I don't know the number of people who live there is small. Okay. But it's unfortunately a town that's seen a huge decline over the last 20 years.
So it's even smaller now.
Yeah. So fun fact, right? I don't know if it's fun, but it's a fact. The nickname of the city is the Magic City because it used to double in population every year from like 1940 to whatever. It doubled in population because there's a large rubber manufacturing is happening in Akron to feed the auto industry in Detroit. So they're putting tread on tires nonstop. Yeah. That's all
they're
doing.
So it's really
in the city.
Where the rubber meets the road there.
Literally. And Akron's known as the Rubber City. So anyway, people are moving there from all over the world. So much so that there's even like little like cultural enclaves in this tiny little city. There's a Slovene center. There's a Hungarian club. There's an Italian club in this tiny little city. But anyway, over time that manufacturing has left not only Ohio, but our shores. So they don't even do that there anymore. So everybody's fleeing the city essentially. So anyway, that's where I'm from. That's where I grew up. Growing up, I always, and I think it's probably true for most kids, teenagers, is it was tough for me to find a place where I felt like I belonged, not fit in, not trying to become something else to be a part of a group, but actually people feeling like I belong because of my, my organic characteristics, not any artificial ones. I found solace.
Yeah. Go. Would you mind going a little deeper and because I think a lot of people feel homeless, maybe a word that I would kind of label on that. And I felt that at seasons in my life where, man, am I like, is there anyone that sort of I can connect with? So I'd be curious if you had more to say on that, particularly for someone that may be feeling that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's tough, right? I remember just feeling it's like a sense of hopelessness, a sense of certainly loneliness. But this concept or idea that you're misunderstood or that you have to somehow become someone you're not, you natively aren't to fit in. And I think that's for most people, that's middle school and high school era, right? even people who are popular probably feel like they're just fitting in. That happens at all times. And I actually felt that in my life for a long time. And then when I graduated high school, I decided to go to school in Florida. So I'm moving from this small town in Ohio to Florida, and it was magical. Not just because Disney was down the road, but because it was literally a transformation in weather and climate and everything. But I finally
found. Was that something you really sought out yourself, or did you? Were people encouraging you to do that, or were they discouraging?
No, no one encouraged. Discouraging 100%. So like I started. The storytelling aspect of my life started in high school, where I wrote a short story for an English class, and it might have been the first time I started feeling an inkling of belonging. Somebody read it. The teacher, I believe it was the teacher, I don't even remember anymore, and said, "This is actually really good." And that was me authentically on a piece of paper. And somebody said, "This is really good. This is what you should spend your time on." So I wanted to go to college to study creative writing, to study storytelling in a more classical sense of.
Was there like, did you watch movies or shows, or did you read books? Like, was there anything kind of spurred it on? Like, one of the things, the original triggers for me in terms of my interest in storytelling came after watching a behind the scenes documentary about Saving Private Ryan, and Steven Spielberg's kind of story inspired me. So I'd be curious if you had anything like that, or if it was organic or something monumental.
Yeah, I think, you know, it was an escape for me from a world that I didn't feel like I belonged in. Stories were always that escape. Reading the stories, watching movies certainly were that escape for me. And in those moments that I was leaving my, what I would guess is my artificial life, I found the life where I felt I belonged. But you know, I wrote that story in I think I was senior in high school. I actually first started going to school, not studying that. I wanted to study just mass media communications was the idea. And then I took an English class in college, and I felt woefully behind everybody else because I didn't know what a thesis statement was when I started college. I was like, I was not well prepared for college. The small town I'm from, the high school, not so good. But that's how it goes. And I felt behind. I didn't think I could do that. And then we had to read Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five in English class. And I read that story, and it was so weird. It was strange. It was offbeat. There's time travel. There's like sex slaves. There's all this weird. There's World War II. It's all these weird things happening. And I'm like, this is a piece of canon. Yeah. I didn't know what canon was then, but like, this is something that is being told that we need to read and write about. If this guy can write about this, then I can do this too. Yeah. Not that I could emulate Kurt Vonnegut, but my stories always kind of took like a weird like tinge to it. And I thought that that would never be accepted. And seeing that as an inspiration, I threw away the shackles of mass media communications. And I'm like, storytelling, this is creative writing.
That gave you the freedom to like, okay, I can be different and make it work in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it can be commercially viable, right? Yeah. Because again, the small town I'm from, not a lot of people have a lot of money, right?
Yeah.
And growing up there, it was very blue collar, you know, just being able to survive was a big check mark, benchmark, I should say. This idea, and that's kind of why my, you know, members of my family told me I shouldn't study this, is because it wasn't going to be commercially viable. And I'm like reading this book by Kurt Vonnegut, and I'm like, look at this.
Yeah.
Like, this proves, it's a proof of the concept.
Yeah.
That kind of like started me on that journey.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah, so,
how do you get from that journey to where you are today with kind of you're telling stories in the business world?
Yeah, it's a fluid transition, actually. And it all comes down to money, right? Because, you know, I get to Florida, I study, you know, creative writing. In that sense, at that time, a lot of people have different relationships or ideas of the idea of social fraternities and sororities. But at that time, I was sought out as a member of a men's social fraternity. And it was very much not what I expected, right? I'm like, I'm watching Animal House. I'm thinking like, it's going to be this crazy thing. I don't want to be a part of that. I have no interest in that whatsoever in my life. But one of my roommate at the time was a member. He was the president of the chapter, and they had to have one of their chapter meetings in my apartment. So like, I'm like peeking through the door while they're having their meeting in the living room. And I'm like, this is a business. This is not that. Right. So anyway, I joined, and that was another point in my life where I felt like people sought me as someone to belong. I wasn't just a member. Immediately after joining, they're like, you need to lead this thing. You need to be in charge of something. Like we need you as a leader. And that felt super empowering to me. And I think that's another pivoting point in my life of people just putting their faith in me. And I think that's somebody today I would count that as somebody saying yes or just a win in general. But like those little incremental pieces are what kind of build the inspiration for everything that comes thereafter. Yeah. So, you know, studying creative writing, doing all of that, I knew I wanted to keep storytelling. So I actually took some time off of after school. I went and worked for my fraternity as a consultant, and my job was to go to campuses all over the country and meet with young men that were like me just a few years before and say, hey, you know, all this stuff that you want to do because you're 19 years old, it's not really building a values-based life for you. Mm. And here's some things that you might want to consider, right? So that was my job, to kind of tell them not to do the things that they wanted to do, but what a path to true values-based living kind of looks like.
What did you find was what did you find was compelling when people responded? Like, because I could see a lot of people like sort of dismissing it and doing it anyways. Mm-hmm. But I imagine you had a message that evoked a response in many cases. So I'm curious when that was and where it intersected with it.
Well, that actually it ties into storytelling quite a bit, because inevitably I'm telling a story to this young man, this leader of a group of other young men. And saying, here's a narrative that we think that I think would be better for you. And essentially, I usually tie that back to ritual. The ritual of the organization is very symbolic. Everything we do in life, there's so many things in our lives that are symbolic. You don't have to be a member of fraternity. The church is very symbolic, and any type of worship is symbolic. The things we do every day in our lives, even in work, is symbolic to some degree. Yeah. But tying back that symbolism to this idea of what I call a shared emotional experience, if we can, in our storytelling more broadly, and in this case with young men, tie back kind of a foundational truth of emotion, like that's really what ties everything together. You remember that, you know, I would say to the young men, you remember that part of initiation where we did this and we talked about this and we took an oath to XYZ. You know, how'd that make you feel? What were the feelings what were the emotions that you had? And they're always profound. Yeah. So trying to like kind of scratch back the layers of the, even to them, the fitting in layers, like this is what college is supposed to be, layers, and kind of getting down to the belonging layers, the vulnerable layers.
Yeah.
Where we had some sort of emotional experience, and trying to kind of relive that in a nostalgic way and help them find a path in which that emotion, that foundational truth, can be more prevalent in their life, opposed to superficial things. I know that's very philosophical. I'm waxing poetic here, but inevitably that's what it comes down to. And the same is true in storytelling, in any aspect of storytelling.
Yeah, because I think fundamentally we're creatures of story and desire, right? And what is it I as a character in the story want, or the story that I'm telling, and what's the role that we play in that. And, you know, I think one helpful question that someone shared with me is like, in terms of just being more practical in the sense of like looking at 2023, look at the end of the year and then go, what's the story I want to tell in retrospect once this year is over? And what do I need to do now to help build that story, right? Create that story. And I think that's kind of what it sounds like you were doing with college. Was like, okay, you could go through your college experience and it just be sort of this sort of whim, ad hoc, follow your desires in a sort of an unleashed way. Or you can sort of have some structure around those desires and make it more meaningful and matter and make it matter.
That exactly.
Yeah.
You're 100% true. And even to this day, I mean, everybody has had a different experience, but that was a profound experience for me in college. It was profound traveling and helping these young men that I'm still, to this day, I'm on the board for the fraternity nationally. So I'm still involved in all of that, trying to help young men navigate that transition from adolescence to manhood, which is extremely difficult and fraught with tons of challenges, right?
Yeah. And I think in a lot of ways in our country and in our culture, we are facing a meaning crisis where a lot of people, particularly young men, don't have what you're describing. They're missing that, or they never did have someone reach out to them like you did.
Yeah, you're 100% true, Jason. Like I think, and I've got a son at home. He's 14, about to turn 15. So I'm trying to navigate those waters myself at home, which is way more challenging than doing it for hundreds, thousands of men on a national level, yeah. Right? But it's this idea of manhood. I think culturally we're told that manhood is about controlling scenarios and other people, and a true man, you know, is master of his domain. But in theory, if you think about it, like the true men that we would like to emulate, they're more about controlling themselves. Mm-hmm. Their conduct, their behavior is in a controlled, self-control is really the definition of manhood in my book.
Yeah.
Controlling others is not, usually that comes from a place of more of a place of weakness or misunderstanding than it does from a sense of purpose.
So bring us along to where that brings in the business. Yeah.
We're still moving, right? I went to graduate school after all of that, studied creative writing even more. I got an MFA in it. So kept going down that path. And at that point, I'm like, I got to make some money because I just started working. I was just working at a nonprofit. I'm broke.
Were you married at the time or single?
Yeah. So I was married when I started working for my fraternity. I was married for a few years. That didn't work out. So I was single thereafter. I went to graduate school for the most part. There was personal challenges, obviously, and all that. And it all came out in my writing, of course.
Yeah.
My creative writing.
Yeah.
But then I'm like, you know, I've got this skill set. I've spent many years since I was a senior in high school to that point of finishing graduate school and countless dollars, actually not countless. The federal government tells me all the time I owe them money and here's how much. And that's nice.
But you're doing something instead of nothing.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it costs a lot of money and I'm classically trained as a writer. How is that applicable? And I got a job as a copywriter and all of this started clicking. I mean, I did some freelancing in the past, but like all of the tenets of classically trained storytellers work in commercially viable content. We've got character development. How is that any different than branding, right? Character development is somewhat the same. Writing dialogue is very difficult. And that's all part of like tone of voice. There are so many elements that are mirrored. It's just about applying a skill in a way that you've not applied it before. And if some writers, and this is what I've learned over the time, can make that transition from the creative side to the commercial side, some cannot. Writing commercially is about writing creatively is usually somewhat an altruistic, task, right? You could do anything you want. There are no barriers other than what's inside your mind. Writing commercially, there's this box that your creativity has to fit in, which is whatever the goal is of the piece of content that you're developing, whether that's views or conversion or whatever. And that's difficult, and some writers can't make that transition. I found a way to do that. I found a way to bring some writer friends along with me to do it, and that's really how Content Workshop was founded. When I started graduate school, this all started to come together. And 10 years later now, we've got many of the members of our team are members from that graduate program that I was in at the same time. And they came with me along for the ride.
Okay. So, and then how does all of that spawn the copywriter exchange involvement?
Yeah, great question. Back in 2020, we had the idea at the beginning of 2020 that we were going to develop these educational courses for writers, mostly just to give back. We had time, we had resources, so like, let's teach people some of the elements of what we've learned along the way, and maybe they can stand on our shoulders and get there faster. That was the whole concept. So we developed this thing we called EDU by Content Workshop, which was a series of courses that people could take about copywriting, some graphic design, some freelancing in general. And we did that. We actually got accelerated because of COVID. Goes off. We lose half of our clients like within a week. We've got time and luckily a little bit of savings and every penny of the PPP money we could get our hands on. And we just laid it out to contractors and writers to help us develop these courses. So we accelerated that to finish it. I guess we finished it in August and the goal was by the end of the year. So that was kind of like the starting point of Copywriter Exchange was this idea of like giving back to writers. So a few years later, we're like, well, a lot of that has stalled because we got so busy. Our agency started growing so fast. And we're like, we now are in a place again where we have the resources to help even more. So we took all those courses. We started writing more articles. We started developing more resources. And we're like, let's just give back without an intent, a specific intention of monetization on the front end. Let's provide advice as much as we can. And it in itself will, if we're providing value in a space to an audience that needs it, it will become viable for us on a financial level at some point in time. Even if it doesn't, we feel good doing it, right? So what does it matter in the end?
Well, I mean, that's, I can relate to that because my first book, Path of the Freelancer, in a lot of ways, it was a way for me to sort of leave breadcrumbs for other freelancers. Okay, this is the systems I created and built that helped me succeed as a freelancer. And I'd like to sort of share that. As opposed to like hoarding it or just not sharing it because it's just in my head. And so that's something I can relate to. And I can also relate to the pandemic acceleration process because this podcast, actually, my plan was to really kind of launch it in 2021, but I ended up launching it in 2020 because of the pandemic. So, so I think it's interesting that you mentioned that because I think sometimes what we want or what we want to go after or our goals, they're kind of, they're incubating, right? And something like that happens and it almost is like, I'm going to go after that because that was what I want. That's what I wanted. And this gives me an opportunity to sort of make that happen quicker than what I had otherwise planned. So.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the same for us. It just helped us. It gave us more purpose around the idea. And I completely believe in incubating ideas. I come up with a lot of crazy ideas. We actually have a meeting, our team, every other Friday that we call the storm. The idea is just to brainstorm crazy ideas. No idea is a bad idea in that call. What are new products and services we could offer? What are some crazy things that we never even thought of before of doing that we could do? Copywriter Exchange was certainly out born out of that concept. So, we try a lot of new things too that don't work out. And that is all part of the process. That is all.
So how do you go about, you've got so many ideas. How do you go about prioritizing the ideas?
I let my team, luckily I have a group of advisors, which is the team at Content Workshop, that'll hear my ideas and give me their feedback on practicality. Mm-hmm. Luckily they're dreamers as well. Which is good because they don't just shoo away all of my impractical ideas. And my wife is actually a great inspiration in that too. She's heard all of the ideas under the sun, right? And every once in a while she'll say, "Now, David, is that an idea for you or is that an idea for somebody else?" And a lot of my ideas are not for me. They're for somebody else because I'm not in the Venn diagram of the person who should be producing this, bringing this thing to life. Mm-hmm. Right. And if I am in that Venn diagram, then I'll take it to the team and ask them. And they are very good because they're all writers. So they as creative people, we deal with a lot of constructive feedback and just rejection in general. That's part of the creative process. So they're really good at saying, that's not something we should do in a kind
maybe
way.
Maybe not, or not ever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. So let's, you mentioned a little bit about, I want to talk about, ask you the question, what does it mean to live better? What does that mean to you? How does that play out? You kind of gave some hints and bits about that in your story, but kind of dive into that a little deeper for us.
Yeah. I mean, better is such a subjective term, right? It's like all of the medications and procedures you can have to increase your quality of life. It is completely measurable on a subjective level and it's real, but it's different person to person, right? So better for me, just living better for me means that I have more time to dedicate to the things I am passionate about and give me purpose. So that's better for me. Personally, this is how I approach better. I don't work crazy hours, right? I work typically 9 to 5. Sometimes I come in at 10. I don't have a full schedule. There's blocks, there's holes in it by design. Mm-hmm. I don't travel as much as I used to. I take off every other Friday from work.
Always done or are those new inventions?
That's all new, man. So 4 years ago now, I met my wife, And at that time I was a marketing executive. So content workshops always been running in the background. And sometimes I've been more involved than others. And I started climbing the corporate ladder while content workshop was growing, outside of that brand, just with other companies. And I got all the way up to the vice president of marketing for a software company. And it was extremely stressful. There's a lot of M&A activity. There were, you know, a lot of conversations and acronyms and KPIs and ROIs and how is this blog going to get us more money? And I have to politely explain like it's not. That's not the main purpose of it. There's a holistic plan here at play, right? So, you know, in all of that, I decided like that's just not the life for me. Mm. I thought it was, but it wasn't. I met my wife during that time.
How long have you been
at that point?
Yeah.
A long time. 10 years maybe at that point. You know, it just wasn't, it wasn't, in alignment with my purpose anymore. So I quit that and I wanted to spend more time with, you know, my girlfriend at the time, very soon thereafter, my fiance, my wife and her kids, which have become my kids now. You know, that's what gave me joy. So I built a life around that. That gave me joy. So I'm going to build a life around that works. Instead of letting my work life dictate my personal life, I decided I was going to do it the other way around. Right.
Yeah.
I'm fortunate to be able to do that because I realize a lot of people don't have the ability to do that, or there's not a clear path for them to do that. So with that, I decided just to work at Content Workshop. Had to save a bunch of money in case I couldn't pay myself for some months, right? Because we had other obligations and bills. COVID happens right in the middle of that a few months later. So that was all difficult, but I just held true to all of those things that gave me purpose. So the time off work, we have a unlimited vacation policy at Content Workshop, and I avail that policy on a regular basis. My wife and I travel quite a bit. We can work from anywhere. So like, you know, we adopt that as well too. Again, very fortunate on all of that, on all of those fronts, because we know that that's not something that that most people get, right? So yeah, I mean that's better to me, right? Is having time for those things that I derive more purpose from. Having conversations like this with you, right? Yeah. Being able to talk about things that are just a little deeper than the superficial elements of day-to-day life, right? That's better to me.
Yeah. So how, you know, I guess the second part of that question would be, what does it mean to work smarter and really talk about that overlap between the personal and the business as well?
Yeah. You know, for smarter, I saw a quote, I'm probably going to botch it. It was on LinkedIn. Some guy posted this interview between the Harvard Business Review and Jerry Seinfeld, okay. Right? And the Harvard Business Review asked him about Jerry and Larry David writing all the episodes for Seinfeld and how much work it was to be a producer and write every line, to be live and present for every line being dictated and then revising and working with the directors and all that. They asked him, like, is there a more efficient way to do that? Could you have hired a consulting agency like McKinsey or somebody else to help you, like, develop a better strategy on efficiency? And then Jerry, he said something along the lines, like, I don't know who McKinsey is. And then the Harvard Business Review is like, they're a consulting agency. And then he asked, are they funny? they're like, no, they are not funny. That's not their purview. And I think Jerry, his response was something along the lines of, it's not about the efficiency. Doing something really well isn't about doing it efficiently. Very seldomly is it, right? Yeah. There are certainly systems in place to help drive and drive more efficiency, but the core concept, the core thing that you're providing to the idea is in your head. It's it's your abilities, right, as an individual.
Yeah.
So the systems can prop some of those things up, but your competency comes from within. So to him, it'd be great to have like better, you know, project management workflow practices for all of these things, but you can't automate Jerry's mind. And I think for most of us, spending less time on the arbitrary things that anybody could do or any system could do is great. spending more time in the weeds on the things that make it uniquely you is really where we're using systems wisely. I get to spend more time on the things that are uniquely me because of efficient systems and tools that are out there, right?
Yeah.
Team members who are good with them, communication abilities that didn't exist before, like a, you know, Slack, like I live yeah. on Slack with my team. You know, we have project management systems like Monday to help keep everything in line. Having like a great group of people around you is a system. I think we don't think about humans as a system enough, but no question, right? Like it is one giant organism and it's alive. It's not just a tool, right? And that having all of that put together, having a plan that allows me to have the time for my purpose, is only because of the system.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's interesting because to the story that you mentioned with Jerry Seinfeld, I think with efficiency, like you might want to have efficiency when it comes to like mundane things. So like if you're trying to make, like I got a fishing pole behind me, you're trying to make fishing poles and you want them all to be exactly the same and you want to manufacture a lot of them. You want that. It's kind of mundane because it's the same thing over and over and you're just trying to make that more and more efficient. But with a TV show, you actually don't want that because it'll just make the show flat. You want the novelty yeah. and the dynamic and the spontaneity, all of those factors. You want to create the context for the magic to happen, but you don't necessarily want to control exactly how the magic ends up happening. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's where and this is true in the content we develop as a company today. We really do seek out this shared emotional experience that I mentioned before, right? Like mm-hmm. we should approach every piece of content, knowing the audience, knowing the pain point, and knowing specifically what we want them to feel when they consume it. And yeah. that's really, in my mind, that's what defines a piece of art, right? Storytelling yeah. is a craft, right? It's an art, certainly as part of it. It has commercial viability, right? So it's more of a craft than anything else.
Yeah. But,
you know, the being able to like consume something, any piece of content, and then having a feeling and then recalling that feeling later or reliving that feeling when you think about that piece of content, that is extremely powerful. That is yeah. extremely powerful. Art is really good at this. Like you see a classic piece of art, whether it's, yeah. you know, Van Gogh or Dali or whatever it is, and you feel something. Mm-hmm. And then later when you think about it, you feel that feeling again. So it's really hard to infuse that into content that's made for business purposes, right? But
yeah.
in the end, you want an emotion. Mostly it's relief because now yeah. I have a path in which to solve my problem, whether that's just advice or a solution that I can buy from this company.
Yeah.
That should be the intentional goal yeah. of that piece and that emotional connection. And that's not, you cannot automate that. Empathy by definition yeah. cannot be automated. It's a human to human feeling. The second you automate, it's no longer empathy. It's, I don't know what it is at that point in time.
I mean, you could certainly have yeah. helpful, like you said, systems and insights and, mm-hmm. and awareness. But it kind of comes down to like the desire and the emotion, the desire and motivation. Like, why am I doing this? And if I'm focused on efficiency and automation, then I may lose the very spirit that drives the empathy.
Right. Yeah.
yeah.
And then you're flat. It's formulaic,
generic.
Which is not a word. You don't ever want to hear generic or formulaic when people are talking about the things that you're creating, right?
Yeah. But we want a voice and a point of view and mm-hmm. some texture to it to give it yeah. To give it life. Kind of like maybe a skeleton versus a full yep. human. You know, the skeleton, you need the skeleton because it holds everything up. But
yeah.
bones by themselves are kind of boring. So.
Yeah. I mean, they don't dance, right? It's the muscle. Yeah. It's the fibers. It's the culture. And that's kind yeah. of like we have a lot of conversations about AI and content today, right? Every client after ChatGPT was launched however many months ago
yes.
was yeah. like, hey, what are you doing with this? Can we just use this instead? Like it's... It really shows who values those elements we just talked about, that texture, mm-hmm. that voice, that those elements of empathy, and who doesn't. Because if you're interested in solely, now I think AI can support a lot of the work that we're doing. And we're actually developing software tools to do that ourselves. Yeah. So that's really cool. But you still need writer generated elements, right? Yeah. Because that's what's going to give you that.
It's all derivative from human content anyways.
I mean, yeah. I mean, yeah. AI doesn't know anything. Yeah. Well, and really it's not AI. We shouldn't call it AI because it's really not. For the most part, it's just autocomplete.
It's the same.
It's a larger library, yeah. Right? Like you, the same tool that has been in Apple phone since 2004. Google actually launched it in 2004 for autocomplete when you're searching for something in Google search. But it's the same thing. It's just longer and broader, yeah. And using a database of the internet opposed to the last 15 text messages you send on your phone to tell you what word should come next. But it doesn't know anything. It doesn't retain any like specific knowledge. It just it's derivative elements, which again can help with some skeleton work.
Yeah,
helps outline research, outline, understanding. You know, a direction. It can help inspire, but it's not going to be the thing, at least yet, the thing that creates something that builds a shared emotional experience.
So kind of on that vein, you know, talk to me about mentoring, because I think that's certainly one thing AI can't do. humans, I mean, it could certainly teach factual information and knowledge, but it's not going to be, like you said, it doesn't have its own character, its own maturity.
Yeah,
that's a human thing, at least it doesn't have it yet. But tell me about mentoring and how that plays a role in your life, or how it has. And I think in many ways, it's kind of where the copywriter exchange comes into play. It's fostering that type of mentoring. But tell me about that more so.
Yeah, this makes me think of a back in the day, I was interviewing a member of my team for a podcast that we used to do. And he asked me a question about this fear that a lot of creative people have, which is, are we ever going to have another good idea? Is it possible that our last great idea was the last one we're going to have and we'll never top it, right? It's this constant. I mean, you know, actors and actresses feel this element all the time. Writers, creative people across the world feel this all the time. And I've not felt that. And it took me a moment to realize why I didn't feel that. And I think it's because I've not derived as much value out of like the greatness of the last thing that I've done. It's always about whatever the next thing is more exciting to me than the thing that's already done. And I think that's because I do believe that the purpose, that my purpose and most, you know, maybe we can call it the secret to life. Maybe that's too broad, but it's this idea of creation, right? Like my purpose and most people, I think, are derived from creating things, whether that's a legacy, whether that's maybe that legacy are the human beings that we leave behind of our offspring. Maybe it's just the relationships that we create and what people will think about us and say about us when we're no longer in the room or no longer on this earth. Right. You know, I think that level of creation and thinking about it on a broader sense gives that purpose. And mentorship is the same thing. I think if we can create things that allow other people to continue to create things, that's the ultimate purpose-driven time we can spend. And mentorship is that, like my ability to lead somebody to become a leader and not just teach them how to be a leader, but teach them how to train the next leader or mentor the next person is the ultimate in creative theory, right?
Yeah.
Me being able to, in Copywriter Exchange, create something that allows other copywriters to live a life of purpose and freedom so that they could create something is the epitome. It's the top of the pyramid for me. Right.
Yeah.
And that's an emotional value, not a monetary one. Right.
Yeah.
And mentorship feeds right into that. And you know, it's tough. It'd really be great if everybody lined up and said, I want you to mentor me, but that's not usually how it works. We have to find elements in our lives where we have a cross section with people who could get value out of the things that we say and do, and try to keep adding you know, layers on top of that and providing that value. And yeah, and that's what we're trying to do with Copywriter Exchange. And I hope more broadly with Content Workshop too. We help a lot of brands create content. And the goal is that they can keep doing, we don't work with companies we don't like. Like, they're all doing good things for the world in their own little space, right? They're all helping mm-hmm. people in their own little space. So if they can keep doing that, then it feels like a, again, almost like a level of mentorship too.
Yeah. And how has mentorship impacted you in terms of people pouring their lives into you in business or personal or both?
Yeah, I mean, I've got definitely a few people who I would call mentors. But I think this is probably telling. They never would know that I would call them a mentor because it's not a formal relationship. I just emulate. I see them do things, and I want to emulate those achievements. Mm-hmm. And mostly, I want to emulate those emotions. Right? There's some men in the fraternity that I met when I was on staff who were on the board of directors at the time, and how they talked to people, how they made them feel, how they helped them, it gave me an idea of how I wanted to do the same. And that was a mentorship type relationship without them ever knowing that they were probably doing it. So there's certainly that. There's other people in life that have allowed me to be like a mentor-like figure to them, and that has taught me quite a bit. I've spoken at colleges and universities. I've even taught some classes here and there. And those elements of trying to teach other people a piece of knowledge that I have and their responses, their questions, their dialogue thereafter has springboarded my understanding of that concept even further. It's the true workshop mentality. The mentor learns from the mentee, and the inverse certainly should be true too. It's a mutually beneficial relationship, whether known or not, I guess, right?
Yeah, we all have something to learn from each other, and maybe those things are different, and that's where the overlap comes in, for sure. What about stories? What fictional or real stories, narratives, have shaped you as a person, or shape you?
Well, we talked about Kurt and his Slaughterhouse Five. That certainly, as a story, has shaped me. You know, it's tough because it's not, I think in life, it's like your favorite song, right? It's not really like my favorite song. It's my favorite song right now, right?
Yeah.
Favorite story right now. But some stories that stick with me are usually because I respect the craft more than the story somehow changed me. It's really so more of the writer, I guess, than the creator than the actual story. But, you know, I empathize a lot with Don Quixote, the story of the tilting at windmills, the mission to civilize kind of concept that has been impactful on me in my life. To the extent of, you know, Walter White, right? And Breaking Bad is probably the best example of character arc in development that has ever been created in
display. So what about it is so compelling for you? And do you relate to it personally, or is it more of the craft of the story?
Yeah, I relate to it personally.
Tell us about your secret business.
Yeah, exactly. It's this idea of change, systematic change. Maybe it's not systematic. Maybe it's more native than that, but or less intentional, I guess, but change over long periods of time, small little nicks.
Sedimentary might be a good word to use.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what it is, right? That character, Walter White, right, has changed so much. He was the guy in the beginning who was on a ride along. He was dying of cancer. He's resolved. He's like, I'm going to die. This is okay. Like, my life really didn't mean a whole lot. It's okay that it's over. To the, I am the one who knocks. I am the danger, right? That is, those two people should not ever be the same character. But somehow they made me believe that element all along by the small incremental changes and environmental factors that play around it.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah.
So go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, is it that they made it believable? Something that seemed unbelievable? Is that the essence of what you're saying, or is it a little different?
Exactly. Okay. And that's most great stories, right? And that even comes into play, I think, in like content on a daily basis, right? If you solve somebody's problem, if you really truly answer their question or provide value or solve their problem, you probably have taken the unbelievable and made it believable to that individual, whoever's reading that piece of content down the path, right?
Yeah. I guess the interesting thing there, just on a personal, like a real level, is I think sometimes we might look at someone like Walter White and go, I could never be like I could never do something bad. I never do something wrong. Mm-hmm. And it kind of opens our eyes to go, actually, that could be you. If the right things played out, which I think is a humbling type of thing. One of my favorite movies is Jurassic Park. And I think that's a similar dynamic where it's like, the shoulders of which we sit, bear much of the strength and power that we wield, without appreciation of it. So
yeah.
I don't know. What would you say to that in terms of just that humility that comes with recognizing our own descent into the abyss or the potential, potential for it?
Well, I think it's funny you bring up Jurassic Park. Michael Crichton is one of my favorite authors of all time. And I know like most of his content, you go to graduate school to study creative writing, they expect you to talk more about more high fluent writers. And I'm like, I'm all about that Michael Crichton. And there are people that are like, they poo-pooed Dan Brown, but Dan Brown's carrying like buckets of money, right? People want to read what he writes, right? So anyway, I think in Jurassic Park specifically, I think an element of all of this is like how these stories affect our regular lives on a practical level. So back to Jurassic Park for an element, like the I'm going to get all the characters wrong, but one of the characters was talking about chaos theory, right?
Yeah.
On a regular basis. And that has helped me so much in my life, understanding that we can model everything in the world. We can model anything out. We can try to turn it into a science. But the second we add the human element to something, there is an unpredictability. Like it's going to be harder to find that final note, right? That's chaos theory, right? To some degree, like this idea that humans throw the wrench. And as running an agency and a freelancer and clients not being happy, clients firing us, right? Or whatever, or there's not a good gel or whatever it is, all the negative things that we worry about when we run our own business or or have those relationships, you have to on some level just understand that part of that is chaos theory. Part of that has nothing to do with you at all. And as a writer, we would think, our mentors would tell us like you submit your story for a publication and that person who read it just spilled coffee on their pants that day or whatever it is. And they're in a bad mood when you're on the top of the pile, forget about it. Right. Like you cannot control most of this. So that has helped me a lot. Like understanding these stories of what is within my control and not has been a huge element that I pulled out. I think also to your point, like seeing ourselves in the characters is really the more I think about it internally is what makes Walter White such a believable character. The second you start to see yourself as the hero of the journey, hero of the story, you believe the story, and that's a whole strategy around storytelling too, right? Is like make the story, particularly commercial storytelling, make the story about the reader, not about the brand. Yeah. And that is a huge step that a lot of people have a hard time taking. It's why a lot of content on the internet is, I call them duck lip selfies. But like back in the day when you just take like, I think of teenage girls just taking pictures of themselves, right? Or seeing, they call it influencers in the wild, right? You see people taking pictures of themselves. Like, hey, look at me. Here I am. You should want to consume the content that I produce because I'm so great, right? Like that's what it says to me when you talk about yourself constantly in your content from a brand point of view. But when you start talking about the audience, literally making them the hero of their own story, that's when you start to see people start to believe. People start to feel that emotional connection, I think. That's a huge element in what drives success. It's hard to prove a lot of these things, right? But I can read two blogs and tell which one I resonate with the most. And they could be about the same exact topic. So I'm assuming that's happening maybe on a subconscious level for a lot of readers.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, there's a kind of talking about Jurassic Park and these dynamics at play. You know, a lot of there are a lot of parts of it that have to do with systems, and we play kind of a small part in that system, and we can sort of participate in it or resist it. But tell me, how do you think about systems, and how do those play a part in your life and work?
Yeah, I mean,
because I think in some ways, you could even use Walter Wyatt as an example. Like, he was in a system, and he kind of was stuck in it, and he bucked that system to create a new one. Now he sort of channeled that into evil, nefarious outlets. Yeah. But something right. there was at least understandable in the sense of, like, the system he was in, he was trying to get out of, wasn't that impulse was a good thing, but it was how he channeled it that was the bad thing. So I don't know if that just to throw that in there as another wrench.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it has to do with, like, environment, right? Like, nothing mm-hmm. happens in a bubble or a vacuum. Everything happens with context. So I think a system is kind of to that level is understanding that all of our actions, the things that happen in our lives, our ability to affect change or not is happening in context of a lot of other things that are going on. Some of them we've created, some of them we have not, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of people fall, victim to being a victim of their own story. It happens a lot. You hear this a lot. Friends, family, you know, whoever you're talking to says something like, or is constantly talking about how it's just not breaking their way, right? Mm. Outside factors, people are against them. Outside factors are making it impossible for them to reach their goals and achievements. And I just simply do not accept that. I mean, I realize that it is true for a lot of them, and a lot of people face adversity, death, no question about that. But the second we fall victim to our circumstances is the second we are Walter White giving into his cancer, right? Giving up, giving the power and the authority over to the system and to the environment that's around us, and not accepting that power within ourselves, right, to affect mm-hmm. change.
That we have agency within yes. the system, even if we are limited by it. Yeah.
And if you don't like your system, change it, right? Like we do have the ability to do that. Our reality is more up here than it is out here. Right. So, I think we are fully in control of those things. And again, there's context, it's chaos theory. There's other people involved which are throwing wrenches left and right, but every feeling you have is a choice, which I think we forget sometimes. Feelings are real. Feelings, there's no wrong feeling, right? You're truly going through that thing when you're feeling it, but you choose that, as much as it might not feel intentional. So I know it's a roundabout way talking about systems and environments, but like we really do control those things. Whether it's simply our ability to how we feel about the things happening around us, or literally like we put ourselves in in that position.
Yeah. So where do you see the intersection of agency and responsibility, and then the need for someone to actually intervene in someone's life to help them get out of that cycle of that self-destructive cycle that you describe?
And that's so hard, right? Because most people, I don't know at what point in time in our lives where something has to be, it's more likely needs to be our idea if we're going to adopt it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, I guess it's a fear of vulnerability, like to some degree of accepting other people's advice and mentorship that we didn't go seek out. Being open-minded, understanding that there are, I think it all starts off with this concept of pluralism, like this idea that we can all have very differing ideas and none of us are wrong specifically, mm-hmm. but that multiple ideas can be a path forward. It's not about right or wrong all the time. There is truth. Like I do want to say, like, there are things that are factually true and things that are not, right? But, you know, I think it's tough for you to accept or even interject in other people's affairs where they're going down a bad path. They're a victim of their own accord or others' accord, and help them if that person doesn't accept the idea that there are more than their own ideas that could be successful. So I would look for that. that element, try to tie to that element of finding whatever that threat is, right? That showing that there's more paths than one. It was an episode of Mad Men where they said people, they want to be told what to do, but they don't want to be told what to feel or what to want. That has to be their own, their own design. But like everybody will read like the 5 tips to becoming a 6-figure copywriter, which I loathe content like that, but that's for another podcast another day. But, they'll all consume that all day long, but like how they should feel about it or what they should want to do with their time, nobody wants to hear that. Mm. So, all that to say, I think it's very difficult of finding that point of intervening, of offering help, open lines of communication, offering vulnerability and hoping that that person will come back with the same vulnerability is helpful. Tell helps.
Yeah. Where does that come from? That fear of vulnerability?
Honestly, I think fear and vulnerability are kind of like one and the same really. I also don't think that weakness is really I don't think weakness really exists. I think it's just vulnerability. It's vulnerability to an outcome that is not favorable. And that kind of manifests itself
there's more downside to being vulnerable than there is by guarding ourselves, right?
I don't know. I think there's an upside to being vulnerable because you'll hear new ideas and concepts and thoughts.
Well, I mean though is that's why someone would stay guarded.
Oh, fear. Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. No question. There's more to lose if I am open and vulnerable because I can be hurt. People get hurt when they're vulnerable. That's relationship 101. But when you're guarded, you do not allow for the opposite to actually happen.
Yeah. Well, you said you have those meetings where it's like, bring the stupid ideas. So what do you do to help encourage vulnerability so that people don't feel guarded in those meetings? What are you doing to facilitate that vulnerability?
A lot of it is like, it's like steps. And I think vulnerability is best. It's best as a one-on-one sport to start. Right. I have one-on-one meetings with my team members and I ask them for their crazy ideas and they'll share those all day long with me one-on-one when they feel like we have an open relationship before they will share them with the group. That's very common. And I have to share one of mine first. Usually. I start more of habit than by intention, but I share about my life with people, with my family, with my coworkers. We start every Monday morning. We have a team meeting where we share what we call one cool thing and everybody brings one cool thing. It's usually like what I did this weekend, or I saw this really cool documentary, or y'all, have you watched this, the latest episode of XYZ on Netflix, right?
Yeah.
But allows us to share. The Last of Us, I've seen it all. It's fantastic. But it allows us to share a piece of ourselves that maybe in other circles of our lives are more guarded and closed off to people, which allows for the next step, which is a one-on-one sharing of a crazy idea, which allows for the next step, which is a group discussion about these things. If we don't shed light on ideas, they will never grow. They will simply stay in the back of our mind, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. So I think you when you hit on the point of like going first, I think that is a huge piece of developing vulnerability. I heard someone talk about it as like the idea of giving people permission to go second by being the one who goes first. And so we can give people permission to go as deep and vulnerable as we ourselves are willing to go. And I think some of that has to do with like judgment. Like, okay, if I share, this terrible thing I did, then you feel safe to say that and not feel like you're going to be condemned for that same thing. At least whatever you think is that level.
Right. Exactly. No question. And that's the whole concept. I mean, I've not really thought about it till this conversation, but a lot of these little things that we've been doing and I've been doing, our team has been doing, is to set up the stage for that vulnerability. We're extremely successful as a business, but only because every person is an agent of change in our business. Every single person it has the authority and the ability to affect large changes and outcomes and positive outcomes for our business. And you know, we don't work in a, what's the worst that could happen, right? Yeah. Like we develop content, we advise copywriters, right? Like we're not saving lives. So even if we, giving people the ability to be an agent of change and letting them know that even the what would be a perceived failure doesn't come with a lot of weight, allows them to really stretch those bounds quite a bit.
Yeah. So how would you contrast that to, okay, so you've fostered this environment of being vulnerable with each other and people being able to share. Now you go on Twitter and you put yourself out there and it's Wild West, right? You could very well be slayed by the masses. So how would you contrast those two environments in terms of, that vulnerability dynamic?
Twitter is not a place of vulnerability. Like, I don't go on Twitter first and foremost for that exact reason.
That's public.
Well, that's the thing is most, for the most part, I don't share with people who are not willing to be vulnerable and accepting back. Like if I'm not looking to foster a relationship with you of vulnerability, why, and you're not looking to be vulnerable back. And I know that's not going to happen. I'm not going to even engage. Right. And it's, I think of it a lot like, social media, the equivalent in the olden days used to be driving in your car, right? You will say anything and yell anything at the guy in the car next to you with your windows up and they can't hear you. Or even with the windows down, because you'll never have to confront those people. Social media is the same thing. There's no weight to being just mean, non-accepting. Use your favorite negative adjective here, right? To those individuals, they don't pay. The price that they pay is not. It's not very heavy, but there's also no value in what they say. So the risk reward factor is out the window. There's no risk. There's no reward for those people who say those things. And when you post and you're vulnerable and you put yourself out there, you have all the risk and the likelihood of reward is very small. Yeah. Now, with that being said, like there's plenty of people who should share their stories publicly to shed light on something that might be unknown about a situation or the world. That public light allows to open the door for everybody to see. So I understand that, but I'm talking more about like personal elements rather than larger systematic issues, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, that's why I don't post on really any, because I don't feel like I'm going to get that. I don't feel like the audience is going to come at least halfway back.
Yeah. It's not worth it. It's not fundamentally.
Yeah. What do I get out of it? Yeah. Right. Like in the end, I'm not interested in being a known public figure. Right. Like I want to help as many people as possible. So to that extent, I post every once in a while, like on LinkedIn, and I really just like a lot of stuff that is great and out there in the world and try to foster like participation that way. But in the end, there's really not much there for me.
Yeah. What else do you want to share? Any parting words of wisdom? Anything you wanted to share that you didn't get a chance to?
Oh man. This has been a great conversation. Every time I have a conversation like this with you, Jason, I feel like it gets more philosophical, and I love that, because how often can you have, I feel like I can be vulnerable with you and share kind of these broader ideas, and you'll challenge me if I say something that you think there's, you don't agree with, or there's a different way of thinking. And I love that.
Yeah.
And I think that might be my parting wisdom is this idea that, again, systems, we talked about systems somewhat in like a tool point of view, but also like an environmental point of view. And I think building a system of people that can be there and provide and listen to your crazy ideas, take them seriously, tell you when they're not for you, there might be for somebody else, and foster that vulnerability that allows all that to happen in a safe place is what I drive a lot of my success from. So again, that's my path. That's completely subjective. That doesn't mean that's the only path. Yeah. But if that's helpful, here to help people along on that path.
Yeah, cool. Well, tell us, so how can people learn more about Content Workshop, Copywriter Exchange? Tell us the websites, links.
Yep. Websites are the best way. If you go to contentworkshop.com, you can find out more about us and our agency. If you want to talk, there's a little chat bot. We took the form off the website completely because it was just getting spammed all the time, even with reCAPTCHA. So we just have a chat bot, and that chat bot comes directly to me, literally to my phone. So if you want to talk to me, you can go to Content Workshop and start a message with me, and I will be the one responding. So there's that. I mean, Copywriter Exchange has the same chat bot feature, and guess what? That comes to me too. So feel free to hit up either of those. If you're if you're interested in content in general for your brand, for the place where you work, if you're in the marketing realm, and even if you just want to talk, you know, I tell people my friendship is free, and it's always going to be. I don't need to have monetary gain out of having a conversation with you. I think people don't do that enough. Offer that. Conversation help. So feel free to reach out on either of those websites.
So who would LinkedIn. Be a good fit for Content Workshop for your agency? Mm-hmm. Like who would be someone that would be worth having that conversation?
Yeah. I mean, if you're if you head a marketing team or a content team, you feel overwhelmed with the demand of content across the company and to reach your business goals, then we're definitely somebody you can reach out to for help. Our value proposition is that we help small and overworked marketing teams in transformative industries leverage content to reach business goals. Everybody should know that by heart, hopefully by now at our company. But that's it. And really, if you're small and overworked, which is everybody in the marketing realm, we probably can help you in any capacity. We do work pretty heavily, like in the tech, cybersecurity industries, because they are very transformative right now, and that just gets us exciting. The only reason we use that word transformative is that it excites us. So it's easier to develop content for things that we like. But we also like work with horse racing farms in Kentucky, right? So there's a span of good stories that can be told by people who just maybe are in a new industry or an old industry and they want to transform it. So that's what we focus on over there. Copywriter Exchange, if you're a freelance copywriter, our goal is to help provide just some value and community for you. There's plenty of articles, free resources. We've got the Slack channel, which is active. We do a monthly webinar. Jason has led one in the past, which was extremely most successful one to date, by the way, Jason. So congratulations on that. So there's a lot of just free resources there, and happy to advise anybody on that freelancer path.
Yeah. And if you join the Copywriter Exchange, you can join the Slack community and continue the conversation there for sure.
Absolutely.
Anything else you want to, you mentioned you're not too active on social, but if someone did want to connect, would LinkedIn be the best place to do that?
It would. Yeah. It's really the only place to connect. All my other social media, I'm like, I've got like Instagram and Facebook, and have a measly number of connections on those because that's more personal life stuff. But if you want to talk content at all, I'm excited to talk it at whatever stage or level, right? LinkedIn is a great place to connect with me.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, David, for sharing your life with us today.
Thank you, Jason, for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Share Life. For additional stories and systems to live better and work smarter, visit jasonscottmontoya.com. That's jasonscottmontoya.com. We look forward to having you listen in on the next episode of Share Life.
Are you a small business owner? Have you hit a glass ceiling where year over year, you cannot rise above a certain revenue level? Check out Jason Scott Montoya's book, The Jump, to discover how to level up your leadership and pivot your entrepreneurial passion to the highest level. The Jump from Chaos to Clarity for your striving small business is available on Amazon. Are you a freelancer struggling to get clients and sustain an income? Check out Jason Montoya's book, Path of the Freelancer, where he provides the blueprint for mastering freelancing and sustaining a business of one. Start generating a six-figure freelancing income. Get Path of the Freelancer, an actionable guide to flourishing in freelancing on Amazon today.